some time, which is really important, because think about all the relationships, and thank God you're aware of it, so they wouldn't be worse, but if you were single and you met all the people, you said, you know, I would love this person, you fall in love with, and you got a little problem because she's married, but that could be the problem. So the wedding ring is a little red flag that says, you know, I'm married, you're not married. And I believe that, I'd like to believe that that would work, works in my case. But in my case, I really think the protection is my looks and my fat stomach. But along the same analogy, what I've come up with is, you know, the disappointment is one thing that's put out the book here. It says warning factors assessment. This is something that, as I said, not all of any of you exactly, but I hope it's relevant to all of you, and I think I'm going to have to talk about this. And to focus on this, for example, I don't like technology risks. And I'm a technologist, more or less, and, you know, I'm a CPA and VA, but I love technology, and I'm totally, but to me, that, you know, rules. So to me, the perfect investment is a parking lot. I mean, I like parking. Never invest in one. It seems like a great thing to own is a parking lot, you know. Cash business, not to go away, nor are you nothing effective. But you can sell out technology risk on a different flag. So I've got a problem that you put the absolute risk on a scale of 1 to 10. Technology risk is probably zero, okay? And then your ability to manage it, because they've got a non-stop. So, you know, physics doesn't really bother me. So you have to say, what's the risk, and how do you handle it? For example, the second one I pointed out is the amount of continued innovation that is required. And that is not discussing the comms, so I'm just speaking for myself. But I would think at ISS, that my God, the continuing technology, if he stops, I mean, he's in a race to get good guys against the bad guys. And bad guys try to think of new ways to do bad things. And so when you're in security, you're constant in that race. So I would say, you know, in my scale, I'd say, oh man, if I was approached by that investment, and I think most of these invest, investment in fortune, but anyway, and I know you committed yourself very personally, you're not going to show that to us, but it was 10 in my factor. This is really curious, and I stay ahead of all the other people in the world. But I think in the Tom's case, they looked at it and said, well, we have, at this point at least, we have the critical mass, we have the resources, the size, the market dominance, the customer base. So it's just part of our business, and we can turn that to advantage. So as an entrepreneur, I would say, oh, I'm not going to make the work in Tom. I may have a better mousetrap, but I'm going to get flat and run over. So the point is that this list is you need to come up with the things that you are comfortable with that, you know, that are uncomfortable. Start off with the things you're not going to do well. Okay? Because that's important. And I'm going to be you, not somebody else. Okay? And I know we've been our partners in different deals in the past, and we can all do certain things well. But stay away, you know, determine what you don't do well. Make sure that what you're looking at doesn't do it. In other words, look away from it. Okay? Another one's like low barriers to entry. That's a scary thing. You know, you establish a business and somebody gobbles you up. And I think Michael's comment was all the guys that created these devices got eaten. You know, the most influential book I've ever read is The World is Flat. On the screen, it talks about the low barriers to entry. So now I'm going to have a question to the tower panel. And I've asked the panel to share with the audience the fact that you would put on your personal red flag list. And these are things that, based upon your personal experience, you'd run away with, you know, like you were a bag or something. I think that bag is something right now. Okay. You should start here. What do you run away from when you look at opportunities?
As an investor or as a...
Well, as an entrepreneur, you know, who's going to invest your time and money, because it's really one of the things.
Yeah, I think there are different styles of entrepreneurship, and people have different skill sets. Mine has always been trying to anticipate broad technology trends and make sure that I participate in a market that's large enough that's going to be growing. The timing is always the tricky thing. Right? The last one I was involved in was had to do with mobility and, you know, delivering data to mobile devices, email, etc. There was no question there was going to be a market. There was no question it was going to be a big, broad market. The timing was a difficult thing to estimate, and we were wrong by a couple hundred percent, but other than that, it worked out. So the kind of thing that I do, I try to stay away from niche markets that depend on timing. Those are two complicated things to me. And if you combine those two, the risk is too high. If it's a broad market, I can generally handle the timing by staying conservative and, you know, basically having staying power to live through the timing. If you're going after something niche, you better not have any time involved in it. It better be quick and fairly certain, be an execution play rather than a technology play and so on. So I try to stay away from combining those
things. The biggest red flag for me when fellow entrepreneurs come up and ask for funding boils down to four words. We have no competition. That just frightens the heck out of me. I don't know about you. It usually falls into one of two categories. Either they're not well informed about the market, in fact there are many competitors, just none who are successful, or it boils down to the fact that there really isn't a market that can be established there. I think that any entrepreneur that we back, we want to make sure that there are competitors, hopefully a number of very profitable and cash flow positive competitors in there. I think especially in an asset market, it's very helpful to have additional dollars educating the market on the need for your products, and one company cannot create that market alone.
I couldn't agree more with both of my my panelists up here. I would add though that I see red flags when I see people trying to build businesses that are really easily implemented as features of broader infrastructure or application players. And I see this very, very frequently, and that makes the barrier to entry very, very low for someone just to add that as a feature. So I try to find, you know, structurally differentiated things that one of the big or bigger players can't do themselves. In other words, that take advantage of something, you know, horizontally across the infrastructure. And I totally agree with Saeed that timing is everything. One of my first startups was when I was living in Boston and had just gotten out of business school. And, I ended up selling a company called Leapfrog Technologies to the company I had worked for previous to go into business school. And I had sold it to a group of investors who sold it to my former company for about 1,000 times what I sold it to them for 6 months later. I learned a really, really interesting lesson. We did all the work and built it and basically ran out of money, and we just thought the timing was too early and sold this company for a couple of $1 million, and they sold it to a very large company less than 6 months later for about $175 million. So that was a learning lesson. It was better to do that at 24 than at 44. But timing, I think, is really important. And the other red flag I see is the man's ability to rationalize. So we think, we put a plan together, and we think it's actually going to equate to reality. And I don't think we do enough. We as entrepreneurs spend enough time risk assessing things. I know I didn't. You know, it was put the blinders on and go. And as long as you work 24 hours a day, magically something was going to come together. But I think, you know, ISS could be a very different story today, because we did run out of money and we ran into some really hard times. I think a lot of you know the story. We were funding the company on Visa cards, on cash advances, and I think we were up to about 37 when even Visa pulled the plug on us. And so we had totally underestimated what it would take to get the first commercial version of the software to market, and we were separated maybe by a week of pulling the plug, because there was just nowhere else to turn. And luck was with us, and it was truly luck. It was not anything more or less than that, but we made it, and you know, the company's a testament to that. But timing is really important.
I think I would ask your question, you can answer it all the time. Because in the case of this, and what your comment and put your comment in it. But I wanted to ask you, because you saw interest for what anybody has to say that may be wrongful. She said, no, you're off my desk, right? Saying, no, that's it. And how he does it consistently, I don't know. But how do you know when it's time to just say, what is the risk of war ratio? So it's time to take your money off the table and further your comments to come.
Okay. My comment actually was, I wanted to just add something to what Michael had said. This business of we don't have any competition is a very common theme. And I've dug into this to see why is that people say this. If you don't have any competition, most likely you're going in the wrong direction. Right? There is no market. There's no competition. There's no market. And what I found is that entrepreneurs are so deeply involved in the nuances of their own business that they don't look at their business from the perspective of their customers. So that their offering, their service, their product, their business looks different to them than various other people who are their competition. And that's why they often look and say, well, we don't have any competition. And if you ask them, what about so-and-so, they have a very ready answer to give you why they're different, and they're different from everybody. The problem is that they're the only ones who know the difference. And the real buyer can't tell the difference, and therefore they miss the competition. Well, that's a common thing. Richard attributes unearned and undeserved prowess to my selling businesses and so on. The specifics of businesses that I've been involved in have been of the nature where you plan have a business with a strategic fit for a bigger plan. Okay. I think any business that you start, you have to have a long-range plan that includes an exit. And depending on what kind of business it is, it have an appropriate kind of exit. My particular background has led me towards businesses where the plan, the business plan, and the exits were defined in terms of having a strategically valuable piece of technology in a broad market at the right time. This is a very high risk kind of business to be involved in, because by definition, if it's a broad market, it means there's going to be a lot of competition, a lot of players. Getting the timing right is a different matter. I never did actually get the timing right. And of course, there's technology risk, because if there wasn't a fairly high barrier to the technology part of it, it wouldn't have strategic value. So the two businesses that I started and eventually sold were based on that sort of plan, where we were shooting for having the right technology at the right time in a significant market where somebody else would pay a very fair price for it. And whether that's the right strategy, whether that's what people should do, I think it's debatable. For certain people, certain situations, that makes sense. It's a fairly high risk kind of strategy. There are other kinds of businesses that, sitting on the other side of the fence, I envy. Businesses that were more based on cash flow or building a long-term customer base or other plays that look less risky and more executable. The kinds of businesses that I was involved in were particularly designed for this sort of risk-reward ratio, and they worked in these two cases.
Thanks for those comments, Jeff. I think it kind of brings us into the next group of questions, which we were talking about collective void. I think there's some good clarity there. I think, yes, it might be, you see a big company like a Microsoft coming down the road, and you have to steamroll, and you may have to get on that steamroll or be part of the road. Mm-hmm. That was the council of this year. Tom was saying is if it's going to be that easy, you're ready to do it. But let's look at, and I think I even also brought us into the area of the things to see. The things that he looks for in business success, and it'll be settled with a bigger company, et cetera. But it brings another handout, the seek list, and it kind of points that I'm going to ask panelists to comment about this and seeing comedy, but I like markets that have a high growth rate. Because when you have a growth, high growth rate, A, it's going to get you a higher valuation when you go liquidate. That's good news. And B, it's forgiving. A rising tide raises all ships. And that ties into what they're talking about now. If there's no competition, you're probably going to be all by yourself and you probably shouldn't be there. Now, something that I like is, I like an inefficient market. And this is, I think, for where, you know, there's a lot of competition, but you don't have a natural monopoly. And you have a natural monopoly, which is telling you that big Apple fans. And Apple, so they came out with the Intel processor and struggling with computers, but he convinced me, and I'm very proud of the Apple. But Microsoft created this monopoly that you really couldn't break into, and now you're going to see a huge battle being played out between the technology and the other. But I like an inefficient market, and the computer business is often not seen as competition. I like inefficiency, because then I don't have to be the brightest in the group, okay? I have to be the brightest guy in the world, you know, it's not freedom to say. I've got to be faster than the next guy. And so I like inefficient market. But the one that's very controversial, that I think the panel went wrong for a while, is I like service components. And I know Charlie Paparelli is looking on service components as well. I think they're one of the first tapping into that concept of thinking about minimizing the risk. And so I put on the table that every service component service is going to limit the company's ability to scale quickly. Venture capital gets turned off by it because you can't put buck over it. However, I asked the panelists, with your personal experience, the most important in the view of technology, do you think having a heavy service component on the solution is a way for entrepreneurs to gain competitive long-term advantage, or is heavy service something that you need to avoid like the plug?
Okay. I think that entirely depends on what market you are serving and what solution you are bringing to market. If you are serving a large end user enterprise type customer, if you don't have some services capability, you're probably toast. At the same time, if you're making network processor units that are going to be component technology on, you know, some OEM's product, you know, you probably need minimal services capability. I mean, we have built ISF with a minimal professional services capability. I think at one point it got as high as 20% of my revenue. Today it's about 3-4% of my revenue. But managed security services or on-demand services, basically serving our customers with security over the wire, which is highly leveraged, automated, and takes advantage of a global security operations center infrastructure that we've built, is absolutely critical to our business. So, you know, in my business, any of you could look at our managed security services and say that's a next generation professional services. But what I like about it is I run that at about 70% gross margin. And it's damned hard to run any kind of professional services body shop business at 70% gross margin, nor is it flexible to changes in market, competition, et cetera, because it's human labor. So I the only way I can answer that question is to say I think it totally depends on who you're serving and what it is you're serving them with, because I would have no rule of thumb to say just services or no services without answering those other two questions.
Maybe to clarify that, amplify it. So what he's also got is magic of recurring revenue, which is a good thing. And the always competing with him, as you mentioned, is highly leveraged. Now the inference is he's got a lot of money tied up in the infrastructure to do all this stuff. But if I'm an entrepreneur trying to show up, I have to have server farms and all this stuff and all this.
It's a huge barrier to entry.
And he's not taking enough money off the table to matter at a given moment. Okay. And personally, you're trying to position a company from providing a system of record to a system of solutions. That's a long story to itself. But instead of competing with these disputes, we're trying to bundle a solution, which we partner with Michael on, to help people focus on what they need, which is lead generation, not CRM software. So that's the nuances, but I would say that Tom did answer it probably. Well, he got all of his services, he just describes them differently.
Right.
And you see the advantage he's when he's done here to entrepreneurs that may have a, I mean, to talk about, you know, a tough situation. Suppose I have a technically better product stock, but he goes to the mass market and he sells it as a hosted solution for a price that I can't even touch because I can't buy the infrastructure, I'm out of there. Which is another reason why you don't mess with the big gorilla, you know, in his own space. And this gorilla is focusing on recurring revenue, so he's built himself a pretty tough hill for others to kind of climb. Michael, would you add to that?
I think there are pros and cons both ways, but I do know that if you go toward the heavy services model, and this is a skill set that most entrepreneurs are lacking, is to make sure that you hire a terrific, you know, great operations person who can really make, you know, watch over it and make sure that those services are being delivered in a top-notch fashion. You know, I believe that the when you're combining a great product with mediocre to poor service, it's a very fast ride to a very bad place.
Yeah, my experience with Mayor Tom's speaker, we sold to enterprises, and it was inevitable. You had to have some service, or you made no headway at all. Couldn't keep your customers without service, without professional services specifically. But we ended up evolving into the model that Tom has as well, which is, I think, different, something that's between the old people-based service and the product sales, which is providing the functionality as a service, providing a hosted application, basically. And we ended up being Verizon Wireless's email service. It was our product, rather than sell it to them, we operated it for them. And it turned out to be the model that worked, and we chased other carriers once we figured this out. But that's the newer version of a service business that does have the leverage of selling a product, as well as being happy element of delivering a much higher quality product to the customers because you are operating it for them. You have the expertise. That's what professional services people do. They bring the expertise to the customer. In this case, you apply that expertise in a central way and scale it at the same time. So that's, I think, basically shape of the future.
You know, in answer with some of my knowledge of what Shady's experience is, and then just said and amplified, if you just hit it, the fact that talks about flexibility, that we did this and then we worked and found this and worked over there. So I think that's one of the critical things that all entrepreneurs would have to say is the plan you come up with isn't going to be the final plan, so you've got to be extremely flexible. And then to follow on along this whole line of moving going here, observe, let's talk about how things change and we're trying to get new opportunities. Now I'm old enough to remember the corner hardware store, I really believe in remember this side. And then we had, you know, Walmart came in and carved them, and then Home Depot came in and carved them. We had the stereo guys and TV guys, and those guys that we fixed them, could throw them away. And now, we get Circuit City and this kind of stuff that followed those guys. And it's just a constant evolution. So I'm saying that, you know, business strategies, you have to be evaluated all the time because you can't have hardware provide hardware store for life anymore like a bunch of these businesses. But just to kind of put things in perspective, technology, going back to kind of interesting, there's an article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, 1989, and it says technology companies are under pressure to cut prices, and computers are getting more powerful as they get cheaper. It cost $15,000 to buy enough computer power to process 1 million instructions per second in 1981. By 1993, it only cost $140. It is $14 now, it is $4. I mean, you know, PDAs they have in their device, you know. I mean, it's incredible. So we have to constantly, you know, think about these technology paradigm shifts. So the question is, opinion is looking to your crystal ball and knowing that things change quickly. Can you tell these entrepreneurs in the audience what areas sort of vulnerable to innovation are more particularly, if you were starting an entrepreneurial technology company today, where would you be focusing?
I am in that position. I sold the last company a few months ago, so I'm out looking for new trouble. And the two areas that I find attractive are one that I just got through talking about, which is basically software as a service. This is, I think, a trend that's in full motion and will spread pretty widely. And the other area I'm looking at is telecommunications, basically voice over IP. The whole industry is going to turn upside down, and there's a lot of pieces being changed at the same time. There will be billions made and billions lost, not necessarily in that order.
Well said. I would like to echo Saeed's comments with regard to the service providers. We look at the ASP space, and I know the application service provider name got a very black name going back 4 or 5 years ago, but there just seems to be incredibly renewed interest. You keep seeing Salesforce's Mark Benioff posting quarter after quarter of great growth. You start seeing Oracle and Siebel and some others posting what were minuscule, almost rounding errors on their balance sheets on the ASP side compared to their traditional providing of CDs and downloads of software to CIOs and others as now being really meaningful dollars and the fastest part of their portfolios. You see Google getting ready to do a full frontal assault. You see Microsoft and Yahoo gearing up with huge data centers and making billions of investments in the infrastructure to get ready to provide those services. Clearly that's going to be an area that's going to continue to grow and be one of the fastest growers in the market. In fact, we're investing in two ASP businesses this year. So I would definitely echo Saeed's comments in that regard. Tom?
Echo what both of these gentlemen have said. I think all on-demand models, both for enterprises and for consumers, are very, very relevant today because the technology has evolved to a point where it can be available on demand. The way that most enterprises manage and operate their infrastructure is outrageously expensive and highly inflexible, and now that there are alternatives, people are starting to evaluate that. I would never, ever, ever in my life have dreamed that 2 weeks ago when I was in Washington at the Pentagon that a general at DISA asked me to operate and manage and secure part of the most critical combat support system network in our military. And we all know in the security business that there is no more elite customer than the DoD. They don't trust anyone. They operate and manage and stuff. It makes no sense for us to do this. It costs too much, it's inflexible. We'd rather find a trusted partner to outsource it to. That is a sea shift in thinking, at least in the security world, because security has always been one of those things everyone wanted to hold close to the vest. This is happening across everything. Also, I think you're going to see a whole fundamental shift in what the telecoms are calling next generation networks. Telecoms are going IP core to edge, and their whole strategy evolves around delivering IP-based services to businesses and consumers over that IP network. So if you look at British Telecom is probably the furthest out with 21CN with their project, $18 billion US dollar infrastructure rebuild, and it's all about delivering flexible and extensible services over the infrastructure. So that means there are lots and lots of things that entrepreneurs can ride on that infrastructure once it becomes IP, and you're talking about access to literally billions of customers when you think about the global telephony network today that's all circuit switched. And so huge, that's a tsunami type effect that will be with us the next 10 years. And I think the other thing that that is interesting to me is to look at the handset business and look at all the different games, services, and things that are happening there. It's mind-boggling. Last year, while we're on a routine visit to Tokyo, I was with one of our customers, JR, which is Japan Railway, but they have basically built a card, and then they've built a smart token into a phone where everything that you do in Japan, you can do with your cell phone. So you can hold it against the machine and get a Coke. When you get to the airport, you hold it against the security counter. It shows your picture and what flight you're on. It's your authentication. It has your passport information. It has everything. It's a little frightening if it gets in the wrong hands. But the fact is, mobility is going to change in ways that I think will absolutely mind-boggle us here over the next couple of years. And I think all three of those areas are great opportunities to explore because they're huge markets. I assure you, you will have competition, but there's plenty of room for more than one to play.
Thanks for that insight. Well, it's working real well. I hope you did. But you just had other subject about writing things down. And two quotes come to mind here. One is the pencil is best box, which you can write down and see what's wrong. And the other one is just write a tomato with an exact man. And the corollary of that is, don't want to go on any road, we'll get you there. So I want to speak to the importance of having a written plan. And I want to pay on the comment about this in a minute, but the other item in the handout, by the way, the one we're not going to talk about is the entrepreneurial faculty test. And that's just my thoughts of a question you can ask yourself. The challenge is you really set out for an entrepreneur based upon how you answer. And so the question could be wrong and the scoring could be wrong, but anyway, I think it'll be interesting, but you'll do that later on. But I didn't have included in here something I thought was incredible. Many years ago, an individual that I have a card for, Stu McKelvey, that got really good. And so he came to me and said, listen, I'm kind of interested in my opportunity, which is neat, which is kind of funny. And he pulled out this list, which I basically, paraphrased in here, and I went, with this, just change his name, so that he first said, you know, I was very into him. But I thought, what a thought concept here. And it's in the handout, and we have some panelists to talk about this, but about writing things down. But this particular guy that was good in sales, he owned a small company, so he took the size of the revenue he wanted to attract, and he had a number of employees, all too small. He wanted the current president's expertise to be technical. Because he said, I'm not technical, I'm really good at sales. So I wanted to be able to augment that versus sales. He wanted a good rough range focus. He wanted an emphasis in life cycle. He wanted the distribution, the current distribution channel, he wanted it to be weak. Now, was he wanted to go to an area where he could immediately make a contribution? It was more on his checklist kind of thing to write things down. He chose an operating system, which is about all the data and things, but it was a suit one thing for a particular time. On the management thing, he said he wanted the management team to be technically strong and support, strong there. But that was his weakness. And he wanted the reasons that he failed marketing, finance, and operations to strength. I mean, what if mine just kind of wanted to do this? Perhaps more importantly, I thought he wanted to focus on customer satisfaction, which I believe very strongly. If I think in a competitive world, there's too little real focus on the customers. And if you really solve the customers, you take care of the customers, you can overcome your growing costs. Too many people, I think, try to compete with having the least expensive product in the market. Only one can. Too many companies try to compete with having the total best technology in the market. Only one can. It's really going to be an entrepreneur. So if you can have the great service, which means your customers will overlook that. So having said all that, maybe you didn't say too much, I'd ask them in all honesty, how much of your business plan do you commit to writing, and how much of your success is based on your ability to win? And please can share your experience with business plans that are written in the back of the napkin. And we could be more than that if you wish to have done this. So it's cool to see Tom Black to start saying.
Well, I think you do have to have a plan. How well it's written and how many pages and so on is not as material as what's the substance of it. Entrepreneurship is caused by a defective gene. You get up some morning and against overwhelming odds, you decide that you can start a new company that has no customers, no money, no employees, no place of business, no reputation, and go compete with people who do have all of those, or at least some of those. So it's a basically unjustifiable, irrational overconfidence. Right? So, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing. It is a double-edged sword. You without it, you cannot start a business. It is necessary to have this irrational exuberance. But you have to, and this is a critical thing in entrepreneurship, you have to recognize it for what it is. Right? You have to know that you are irrational about this, you are overconfident, you're inside this thing and you can't see what's going on. Right? There are different ways of addressing how to overcome this. But you need a rational plan. A rational plan has to understand, truly understand, beyond just believing. It has to have some, using one of Tom's words, it has to have rigor involved. It has to have a test of the market. Does the market really exist, or are there indications that the market would exist? Are you the right person to do this? Do you have all the requirements, including distribution and finance, et cetera, technology worked out? You have to have a good rational plan, rational to other people. It is always rational to the entrepreneur. How much you document this depends on whether you want outside money or not. And how much do you change it? Frequently. Right? The two businesses that I've been involved in, first one, the first plan was just successful enough to let us survive until we did the second plan, which was more successful. The second business that I was in, it was the third version of the business that actually got traction, but the first two were close, successful enough to provide sustenance and keep us going as a business and give us the opportunity to change the plan. It's rare that the plan works as envisioned the first time, but there has to be a plan.
In one of my prior lives, I used to be a military officer, and there was an old saying in the Army that there is nothing more dangerous in wartime than a second lieutenant with a map. And I would suggest to you that a simple, realistic plan with good execution of the team and great understanding of that simple plan will take you miles beyond, an elaborate plan with exotic spreadsheets. I was speaking to Sig Mosley a few months ago, on this, and I would concur. I always get frightened when I see those, 80, 90 page business plans, sent over to me, way too complicated. There's no way that a very, very small, entrepreneur-driven, young, team is going to be executing to a 90 page exotic planning document. So keep it simple.
I think that the purpose of a plan for leadership certainly is to communicate and then to execute. And so I'm a big believer that the planning is important. The plan itself is less important. So the preparation of the mind, the preparation of the team, the communication of expectations, both, the mutual expectations at the end, and the process of planning, to me, is so much more important than the plan itself. So I think our original ISS business plan, which was an absolutely scientific wild-ass guess, had us at $30 million by year 5, which was a pretty ambitious plan. I said, oh, you can't do that. That's outrageous. And I go back now and I look at year five, we were something like $190 million company. So we were way, way off in a good way. I'll bet there were 1,000 new plans in between that time, and nobody kept going back to the plan and saying, boss, slow down. You know, we're way ahead of this plan. I think it's the planning that's important, and it's important for conditioning your team, it's important for communicating, and it's important for executing. Because in the end, businesses succeed because they execute, not because they have smarter people or because they had the first product or anything else, but they execute, and they execute, and they execute. And you know, without a plan, it's hard for people to do that, especially you know, when you get a little bigger. When you're five people, it's a little easier because everybody can communicate in the same office. When you're 500, it's a little harder. At 5,000, it's again incrementally tougher.
You know, I would comment, y'all know Howard Morrison, probably a consultant, Howard Morrison, years ago. Howard was kind enough to do an own personal to Atlanta, which was excellent. He tried to do excellent dealing. We became very good friends over the years, and we paid back to him. But when Howard said we made a loan, yeah, he wants to get plans, but you know, the planning is important to do business. And he said, I love it, your money fast. And I said, you know, Howard, you were a pretty good risk factor. He said, no, I didn't, because I knew you were paying back. He said, I look at entrepreneurs, and I know the plans are not to work as they expected, as Tom said, but it's the kind of guy who's going to move and be flexible and adjust. So invest in people more than the plan. And he was very successful in making a loan when he said it. So further along, we got a line of what Saeed said, a good quote from Tom Peters, who we all know. And he talks about entrepreneurs. He says, crazy may hold the key to radical change. He says, only a person with a large ego, unreasonable self-confidence, a streak of rationality, thick skin, and a touch of paranoia stands a chance of success. He goes on to say, ages of necessary radical change seldom lurk behind the typical styles of general demeanor and individuals. Time Magazine defines entrepreneurs as visionaries. They're possessed creatures, men and women, their small beliefs so powerful that they ignore all else, even reason, to ensure that reality catches up with their dreams. Closing with a positive note, business marketing says, an article about selling entrepreneurs, and it says, the positive side, the entrepreneur is confident, optimistic, courageous, determined, energetic, single-minded, intense, and resourceful. Apparent disaster challenges, and even recharges them. Anyway, he is incredibly ingenious at solving problems at the last minute, including financial. I think we all have to share because we both do rabbits out of the hat. But we have just a few more minutes before our 9 o'clock hour, and at this point I'd like to turn it over to anybody that has given the panel any questions you might have. Some questions? The panel wasn't that good that you had no questions. Yes.
How useful was, in our interview we had one investor in the center, actually Saeed had been an investor over 930 families, but the truly strategic investor, have you had experience with that and the benefit of that's over a regional?
My, Jerry knows me from group of people where we actually look at early stage companies and invest. I have invested fairly actively in, passive investments, but I've been active in the market. I would characterize my investments as community service. I make money by doing my own business and then give some back. In the form that I create jobs and help Bill Leonard with his business. I'm not qualified to answer your question.
Can you reframe the question?
Well,
I didn't understand it. Do we have experience with strategic investors?
Well, I know that Kleiner was engaged.
Yes.
Clearly are viewed as a strategic investor. Well, when you compare a smaller regional player with a financial operational background versus a strategic investor, can you contrast the two literally, or do you have significant investments?
Sure. Oftentimes, I think venture capitalists, depending on the period in history, have gotten a bad rap, but it wouldn't necessarily come from me. I have raised venture probably 8 times for 2 different companies that I started in Boston, and then when I came back home to Atlanta, we raised capital here both through friends, smaller investors like Imlay and FIG. But we had a very deliberate strategy to try to pick a different kind of venture capitalist for this company, for ISS, because I had worked with some non-strategic venture partners in Boston and just had a bad experience. They got very nervous. They wanted all their money back. And you know, we were spending their money. That was what it was for. And we wanted to go with someone that would be with us for the long haul. And something that most people find very, very unusual with ISS is my 2 original venture capitalists still sit on my board 12 years later. And so while they are still actively engaged, they live in California, they travel a long way to get here, they expose themselves to enormous amount of risk on a public company board because they're both extremely wealthy individuals. And I would say all 4 of our venture capitalists, the Series A and the Series B rounds, still sit on this board as a public board, and they still add tremendous value, and they're still my toughest critics. You know, they still manage me like I'm a 20-person startup. So they tend to get their fingers in my stuff a little too deep. But I think it says a lot for their commitment to the company. All those guys said, we'll stay with you as long as you want us to. And I'll tell you, 12 years later, they are still there. And I hope they stay, you know, for as long as they can, because they're very, very helpful and very insightful. And I think they know the company quite well. So we picked good partners there. Like Saeed, I also do a lot of community service. And so, you know, I try to help, you know, the entrepreneurs any way I can, but I strongly encourage them to go find deep pockets and big venture firms with people who will be committed to them, because my experience here at ISS has been so incredibly positive with Kleiner Perkins and Greylock and Sigmund and the team that I brought in from Boston and the West Coast. They're still committed.
You can add to it, and I have one last question.
I guess I can try to take care of it from the other side of the house. You know, we aspire to be and wish to be a strategic investor. When a VC firm typically comes in, they typically tell 3 things. So, of course, the money, the expertise, and their Rolodexes. We try to go quite a bit beyond that in the form of literally providing shared services. You know, why would you want to stick a CFO into a 10-person startup? It makes no sense at the early stage. You know, we provide the financial management. You know, why would you want to really staff up the sales and marketing side beyond just a few people at the initial stages? We literally have shared marketing services. So we try to go beyond to really make sure that company gets started with a plan on a reasonable investment.
Mike, we'll give you the last question since you raised your hand.
Thank you, Richard. Market cycle. I'm interested in whether you guys view that whether it's better to get in on the top or down, or it doesn't matter, or the economy's good, the economy's bad, or money's available or money's scarce. Do you have any sense of what would be better or worse timing to get into a new venture?
I've always ignored the market cycle, the economy cycles. I'm focused on the market that I was trying to specifically address. What was critical to me was what was the future of what I was getting into. Because often the time frame involved in this stuff is encompasses market and economy cycles. So kind of the material when I start to try to predict. I have a difficult time predicting, but I'm getting into, so I can try to ignore everything else.
Just that, you know, it might be less important what the market conditions are at the point you start it as to what the market conditions are at the time you plan to exit. And so we try to look, you know, forward 3 to 5 years, depending upon when an entrepreneur wants to exit, and take a wild guess as to what, you know, what businesses will be hot, what markets will be hot then, in making our decisions up front. We almost always get it wrong, but we try.
Well, with that, I will close by thanking the panelists for joining me this morning. I think you guys have an outstanding job. And thank you for giving your time this morning. And just closing, we bring you plenty of comments, my observations starting businesses. Starting a business is like, no matter what it takes, it's going to take 120% of what you plan. It's going to take a lot longer than this morning. So thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you,
Michael. Scott, do you want to talk about
Sure. I want to thank everybody for coming out. Hope everybody will join us again next week. Next month, August 15th. We're going to weekly formatting now. All right.